Welcome to the Holistic Health Podcast, where we delve into topics that bridge wellness and science for the skin, gut, mind, body, and soul. This podcast is brought to you by Gvome, where we believe that each of us has a unique ecosystem and path to reach our full vitality.
I'm your host, Dr. Raja Sivamani, an integrative physician and an Ayurvedic practitioner. Gvome is the notion that our jiva, the Sanskrit word for vitality and the essence of life, merges with our many ecosystems that compose our biome to form our unique Gvome. This podcast is meant for educational and informational purposes only. None of the information presented here are a substitute for professional medical care, and this podcast does not constitute medical advice. If you have a medical concern, please consult with your physician. Hi, everyone. I'm really excited to welcome you all to the Jiva podcast. And this has been something that I've been thinking about for quite some time. My name is Dr. Raja Sivamani. I'm a physician. I'm a board-certified dermatologist. I'm also an Ayurvedic practitioner. And today I'm going to give you all a little primer into Ayurvedic medicine. But really what I want to do is just introduce you a little bit to why we wanted to put this podcast together and why I'm so passionate about the word holistic and holistic health. So let me just tell you a little bit about my journey so that you can see where I'm coming from. And we are going to have so much fun on this podcast. You're going to hear from all kinds of perspectives. But really, it's about left brain versus right brain. I mean, we should be using whole brain approaches to health, not just one side or the other side. And growing up, I played a lot of music. So that you know, it was just part of my fiber and ethos. I grew up playing an instrument called the veena. It's a stringed instrument. It has 7 strings on it. And it's a South Indian instrument. And a lot of the music is, once you've learned the basics, and you know, it's really funny, when you learn the basics, it's really so focused on the left brain. How do you pluck the strings? How do you pull the strings? How do you move from note to note? What is all the theory about? So all of that is just really left brain approaches. But then as you learn more and more and start performing, and I perform quite a bit, I haven't been performing, I wish I was performing more recently, to be honest, but as you start to perform and you start learning and you see all the improvisation, some of those things are steps that only you can walk. No teacher can walk you through how to improvise. You can try to learn some basic improvisational approaches, but at the end of the day, you have to walk that, and that's all right brain. And you know, one thing that I've realized is that when you first start learning anything, you really focus on the left brain, and sometimes you think everything is just about the left brain. And it's something that I've seen across many different approaches. Anything that you're learning, you do have to take a left brain approach in the very beginning. Not always, though. I mean, there are things with creativity, but even then, you have to learn the basics. And the basics are always left brain, like technique, style, and making sure you have precision in the things that you're doing. But as you go along, I think in anything, as you learn more and more, it's just one of the great paradoxes and ironies of life. As you learn more and more, you start to realize you actually have a lot more to learn, and you don't know as much as maybe you thought you knew, or it wasn't as neatly packaged into this theory that you had originally learned. So this happened in music for me. When I learned music and I started to perform, I started realizing with the improvisation that, you know, I could do things, I could try out things, but some things just felt right. And there were still certain rules within ragas. If you're not familiar with South Indian music, they have different, what are known as scales, but it's more than that. The scales have life, and the scales have ways that the notes have to be played. And then put on another layer when you're playing with other folks, because usually when you're performing, it's not just yourself. You have to actually partner with another percussion, or sometimes there's another instrument, say a violin, or I've played in fusion concerts where I've played with a sitar or a sarod, and I've also played with guitars and banjos. So, you know, there's then this sense of, how do you connect with each other and make it still sound right? And so I've learned along the way that the more and more you learn, the more you realize you need more and more perspectives to really expand how you're going to experience. And for really good music, you need influences from everywhere. And I feel the same way about health. And so my journey through health was, I was a bioengineer when I went to undergrad. I love math. I absolutely think it's so gorgeous, the way things come together, the way you can describe the universe and describe the world with mathematical formulas. But there are some things you can't use math to describe too, and I'll come back to that. But I mean, you can't describe love with the mathematical equation. It's just not possible. But the thing about engineering that really hooked me was that you could take an abstract concept or an abstract problem, and you could just use general concepts that you learned and adapt them to figure out a solution. I love that. I love this notion of figuring something out. So engineering, although at first blush, it looks all left brain. Again, you learn the left brain stuff early, but as you go along, you start to realize when you have to adapt things, you got to bring that right brain in there. You got to bring that innovation, that creativity, and that out-of-the-box thinking approach if you really want to get to an answer. And so again, it's just whole brain approaches to life. And so when I went through engineering, I felt like something was missing there, that I wanted a bit more of a connection with the human spirit and the human experience. And so I went to medical school because it's something that I've always wanted to do, just learn how to connect with people. And I went to bioengineering as an undergrad because I wanted to learn, oh, how can I come up with solutions? But I realized sometimes the solution is holding someone's hand, and that's not something that I want to do with engineering. I actually want to just hold their hand. So I went to medical school. Medical school was amazing. I am not one of these doctors that became jaded and felt disenfranchised that, oh my God, what I learned was not good enough. It wasn't any of that. What I learned was really good stuff. I learned how to diagnose. I learned all the biochemistry and all the inner physiology and how the body functioned exceptionally well. And not only that, we get really good at diagnosis and also symptom management. And sometimes one of the fallacies that I think happens outside of conventional medicine is that they think that doctors don't look for root causes. If you go and visit a doctor and they only spend 5 minutes with you, that doesn't mean every doctor is focusing on only spending 5 minutes with you. And I think that's sometimes what happens. We want to generalize, but there's so many physicians that are out there that are doing research, or they're really trying to delve into a singular problem where they just have a group of patients that are focused in this narrow area and they're trying to solve a problem there. And so this whole notion of root cause, I mean, Western medicine, conventional medicine does try to look for root cause. The problem, though, is that it's narrowed. I didn't have any lectures on nutrition. I didn't talk about mindfulness or mind-body unless I joined our integrative medicine interest group, but it wasn't embedded into the normal curriculum. And, you know, sometimes people ask, why is that? And I think part of it is just there's so many things to learn, and you really want to learn those quantitative aspects really well. And during medical school, I started doing quite a bit of research too. I was in the lab working with cell culture and learning how the inner workings of biochemistry and cell biology work. And I mean, I was literally pipetting and coming up with experiments. But you know what? I enjoyed it. I really loved it. None of that I felt like I did to try to get to the next step. I don't believe in stepping stones. I think you do things that you enjoy as you go along, and you've got to enjoy the journey. So medical school was totally amazing. I felt like there was a big piece missing, though. But again, I wasn't upset about that. I just realized, hey, you know, there's a piece missing here and I need to go explore. I need to explore this for myself, that I need to understand how can I better tune into imbalances. In conventional medicine, what happens is you tune into imbalances by when someone shows up with a disease. And if you have micro imbalances, it's frequently labeled healthy because the model is let's treat the symptoms. If you know the cause, go treat that. And by the way, we do actually try to treat causes in Western medicine if you can. It's just that sometimes in that scientific research paradigm, you can't find a cause. And then what happens is you get into this rut of just treating symptoms. And that's where I think it becomes an issue, is if you're frequently just looking at symptoms, even though there's a lot of people looking at causes, then it becomes symptom management. But the whole concept is, are you disease-free? If you don't have a disease, then you're presumed to be doing okay, you're healthy. But we know that we still have micro imbalances. I mean, there are many examples of this. For example, if someone has an issue with the foods that they eat and they see that, oh, I get bloating every single time I eat this food, that's not really a disease. When you go to a conventional doctor, they're not going to be able to pinpoint that and say, oh, maybe it's the spice that you're eating. Because honestly, I got one lecture on nutrition, and it wasn't really looking at how to eat well or how they can cause imbalances in your body. It was really about, oh, if you don't have enough vitamin C, you're going to get scurvy. So we learned about people literally not eating nutrition to the point that their body was breaking down, or the body was struggling because they didn't have enough nutrients. But what I really wanted to learn was, how can we manage these micro imbalances so that then you don't get to what we'd call the macro imbalance in a disease? So, and that's where I want to give you an overview on Ayurveda, and I'll come back to that in a second. But then as I went through Ayurvedic medicine, and I did that as soon as I finished medical school, I realized, okay, I want to learn more about these micro imbalances. I started to understand that after I went to Ayurveda training, that we still need to build those bridges. It's because Ayurveda's got its silo, conventional medicine has its silo, and there's got to be a way to build these bridges. And I started to see these bridges and how they would come together. And, you know, it took some time really to think it through. And during this time, I was also in residency for dermatology. And let me tell you, dermatology, oh my God, what an amazing field. And with this podcast and just in general, I really look at holistic health, meaning outside of the skin. I really like talking about nutrition, what are different sort of like meditation approaches or breathing approaches. I frequently have these conversations with my patients, but the skin is so interesting. It is really this window that is able to bind things like social interaction, psychological state of mind or psychology, and also your physical state of health. Many times you can see early markings on the skin that give you a clue that someone's headed towards diabetes. And only in dermatology can you figure that out. Or there can be an extra bit of inflammation on the face. And you know that if they have rosacea, for example, maybe they went out in the sun, or maybe they're drinking cups of coffee that are really hot, or tea that's really hot, or they're eating extra spicy foods. Or if there's an issue, say that, you know, their hands have certain kind of calluses on them, then you get to have these fun conversations about what kind of work do you do? Because you know that the body's a reflection of not only what you put on the inside, but the kind of things that you're doing and the environment that you're living in. So I just felt it unified a lot of different aspects. But I do want to have conversations that are much more transcending, that go beyond any one organ. Because at the end of the day, we are not robots. We're an interconnected being that has many different facets to it. So that brings me to Ayurveda. And let me just give all of you a tiny primer on Ayurveda. Ayurveda is a system that was born out of India. It's been there for thousands of years, 5,000 years, and it's built up empirical knowledge. And I think it's really important to differentiate empirical knowledge from controlled research. Empirical research is observational. So, you know, you figure out, oh, this herb did this, and this herb did that. And when you talk about 5,000 years of observations, that is quite a lot of observations. So there is some power in that evidence. I think now what we're starting to do is figure out, how do you bring that evidence into this controlled model? And does it always fit? No, not always. But there are ways to study it. I mean, why not take people and type them by their Ayurvedic typing and then study an intervention instead of just like a one size fits all? And as I get into imbalances, let me tell you why I'm so interested in looking at micro imbalances. The way, and I'm a researcher as well, I run a clinical trials unit. We do a lot of clinical studies. And so apart from the basic science work, meaning laboratory work, actually work on things like nutritional interventions. We recently published on almonds and wrinkles, and also things like probiotics, or if you're using a different sort of botanical on the face, or a phytochemical, or even a pharmaceutical, a standard drug, how does that affect the body? So I have that perspective to look at it from the clinical research aspect too. But here's how research works and public health approaches are typically taken. You study a group of people and you get an average response that you then glean out of the study, which is highly controlled, really important when you're talking about evidence-based medicine. And the approach is, you take that average and you apply it to everybody out there. And what you expect is, if it's a really well-done study and it's able to be what we call generalizable, then in that scenario, you can get this one intervention to everybody and expect at least some sort of a response that's positive, and you feel like, okay, I had good studies behind it, so I think it'll work in the majority of people. That approach is okay, and in fact, in many times, it's very good, and in a few times, it can be excellent if it really does have this unified approach amongst everyone. But the problem is, we all have unique tendencies, and it's this whole notion of a bell curve. Got to bring that engineering back into things. It's a bell curve where not everybody's going to respond the same way, and some people may have been suited for slight variations, and that's where evidence-based medicine has to be nimble. And we can't just say, this is the one thing that we're going to do, and we're going to apply it to everybody, because I frequently have patients that would never have gotten into the study in the first place. They maybe didn't meet some criteria, or they had some extra conditions that they're dealing with that would have kicked them out of the study. So evidence-based medicine doesn't mean that you're not trying to be innovative. Even in conventional medicine, you frequently have to find ways to be innovative. But here's why Ayurveda is so innovative. Ayurveda takes the notion of the five elements, and I'll go through those five elements, and then something known as the doshas. The doshas are physiological energies, and they're broken down as vata, pitta, and kapha. And this is something probably, if many of you are familiar with Ayurveda, this is how it's talked about when you go online or you go into Google and just put a search in there. You'll get back information about the three doshas. Well, here's the concept behind Ayurveda, the basic concept. The basic concept is everybody has a harmonious balance. Your balance may not be the same as my balance. Someone else's balance is also going to be a little bit different, meaning their tendencies to, say, inflammation, or their tendencies to gain weight, or their tendencies to eventually lose their hair. And this is something that even in the Western world, we know that people have certain genetics. Now, how those genetics present, the epigenetics, are really controlled by how you're going to eat or how you're going to live. That also we know, that your genes are not your destiny, that you still have some control. But going back to Ayurveda, so in Ayurveda, you have this notion of your harmony, but then you can have imbalances that form. And the imbalances are frequently described along these three doshas. So vata is much more about, just to give you a baseline of what the vata dosha is, it's made up of the elements air and ether. And I'm going to go over the elements because I actually think the elements are super important. But air and ether. And the idea is that you can have this notion of movement, whether it's movement in the body or movement in the mind. And when it's in balance, we need movement. We need motion. That is what keeps us going. Motion in the mind is what keeps the mind active. Motion in the body is what keeps the body active. If it goes out of balance, then you have too much of these air and ether elements, which can lead to anxiety or poor thought process or the breakdown of logic. And then in the body, it can lead to accelerated aging and accelerated dryness and accelerated motion where you might lose water out of the skin, is one small example. Another dosha is the pitta dosha, which is frequently represented as a combination of fire and water. That sounds paradoxical, but I'll come back to why that's important, because in pitta, there's an inherent balance and a push and a pull that occurs. But pitta is really about transformation and energy, so it could be literally just enzymatic reactions in the body. In the mind, it can be things like driving motivation and driving intensity. But when it gets out of balance, that's where you lead to inflammation. And inflammation is the fire element. But then you have the water element, which is the swelling, the what we call edema. And so you can see how with pitta, that kind of ties together. And then finally, you also have the kapha element, which is earth and water. And it's all about the grounding nature of things and structure and the structure of your bones and the strength of your bones, or structure and strength of your skin and the collagen in your skin. But it can also mentally represent steadfastness, keeping with it. And in cases where it gets out of balance, that's where you could have things creeping up like depression and stubbornness. So these are how the doshas are all laid out. But let me talk about the elements, because that's really fun. When you have someone that's going out of balance, you're trying to figure out, okay, which of those three doshas is out of balance? And in some cases, you also are thinking about the elements, like which elements are out of balance. The elements is much more fundamental in Ayurveda, and you won't see this much when you're looking this up online. But when you're thinking about the elements, you have earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And I'm just going to quickly do an overview, because we'll come back to these concepts over time, and you'll even see it on the Jiva Factory website. We'll talk about earth, water, fire, air, and ether. And so if you go to Jiva Factory, you'll be able to read about it. But earth is really about substance. Earth truly represents structure and strength. Like you stand on the earth, it's very solid. Same concept. So the earth element in balance represents structure and solidity of the mind and the body. When it goes out of balance, you could have situations where you have too much stubbornness, too much rigidity. And that can also lead to things of rigidity of the body, rigidity of the skin. If the skin gets too much scarring in an area, That would be a representation as another example. So that's earth. Water is literally water. So that could be water in the body or water in, and in the mind. What that represents is just your capacity to take on any sort of stress, because water is very absorptive. We use it, like, as an example, if you have something really hot and you plunge it into water, it absorbs all that energy. So that concept is there too. And let me just back up and say one thing. These elements are translated from Sanskrit. Many things are lost in translation. But the idea is, when you say earth, water, fire, air, ether, Ayurveda is meant to describe the entirety of everything around you, not just the human body. So if you're looking at a rock, a lot of earth element in there. You're looking at a lake, a lot of water element in there. If you're looking at fire, well, needless to say, that's the fire element. But anything that you're looking at is going to have these elemental characteristics. Doesn't mean that you look at something and you're like, oh, I don't see the fire in there. No, but you might see the energetics of it, and that is the fire representation. And so these elements, when they get translated to English, they lose some of the essence of the translation. But just realize that, and what I'm trying to do is just translate it back and bring in the biochemistry. With water, water also represents the water content in your cells, but it can also represent the antioxidant capacity of your body, not just in your mind, but if you have antioxidants on the skin that are natural antioxidants, that's represented by the water element. Or you have the blood that's flowing and the water content in there and the ability for your blood to take on any sort of oxidative stress, that's water element. And so, you know, it plays a really important role in thinking of tonifying the body. So you're trying to increase that water element. Fire literally is fire, in the sense that it's transformation. Fire represents transformation, represents energy. So if you have the fire element represented in the body, that could be enzymatic reactions like vitamin D that forms when sunlight hits your skin. It can also represent motivation and desire in the mind. And so you can see why the Pitta dosha, which is made up of fire and water, would represent this notion of intensity and also inflammation. But if you really break it down, that fire element really is focused on transformation and energy. And that energy can become negative if you get overly angry or overly intense, but it can be really positive because it can drive things like motivation and the ability to just get stuff done. When you come to air, the air element is really about movement. This truly is about movement because air is free flowing and it flows very easily and gently. But of course, if air gets out of control, it can become very tumultuous and tempestuous. And so when that happens, you can have a lot of chaos. So just talking about what it is in balance, in the body, it's movement. It's movement of the hormones that move around. It could be how the blood circulates. It could also be a sense of how the cells are moving things around. Yes, there's energetics, but there's also movement. In the skin, for example, water naturally leaves through your skin. We'd all just naturally lose micro amounts of sweat. That's the air element, that motion. In the mind, it's the ability to form thoughts and kind of move forward with things. And that's important to keep your mind active. When it gets out of control, too much air, too much motion, too much thoughts, anxiety. And then you get lost in your thoughts. Or it can also lead to things like if there's too much movement in the gut, then you're dealing with things like loose stool, or you might be dealing with diarrhea. So that's, again, the air element that's coming into play. Ether is probably my most favorite element. Ether is also the toughest to wrap your head around, but once you wrap your head around it, it probably will help you on a path towards probably the things in life that are going to matter the most. So just to break down what the ether element is, ether literally means space, like ether. The ether around you, it's space. So space is represented by, say you look at your body is literally taking up space. It's just that you see your body in that space. And when you look, say, in front of you and you see a wall, there's space between you and the wall. And it just represents potential. Ether represents the potential not only in your body, but it represents the potential in your mind, your capacity to see that potential and hope. And also, it could negatively also affect the way that you perceive potential, because then you might be pessimistic or optimistic. These are all facets of the ether element. And when you're looking at it out of balance, it's what really speaks to aging, the aging process. in ether, say you have 1 centimeter, you have a 1 centimeter block of, and I'll go back to skin because skin is just really easy for all of us to visualize. If you have 1 centimeter of skin, and over time, as things, you know, you get exposures or you're aging, that skin starts to thin down. And I think many of you can relate. If you're young, maybe you can't because your skin is still nice and thick. But as you age, you'll see that your skin starts to thin down. Well, the way Ayurveda thinks about that is that, well, now you have more of this space element that just is existing there. And the actual substance has now taken up less of that potential space that was there. And so they look at that as a way to describe the body and describe aging process. In the mind, if you have too much ether, you're lost in your thoughts. So things like Alzheimer's are one representation of where the ether element has gone way out of balance. Or if you have schizophrenia, that's another situation. Or, you know, it could be even if you're on a drug high, you really tie into ether element, which is, you know, part of the reason that, you know, people get hooked on things like drugs and whatnot is it gives you this out-of-body experience, and that really is represented by ether. If you can bring that into your life, gosh, if you could have an out-of-body experience every day without needing extra chemicals to do that, that's fantastic, right? So that's why I think ether is so important, and channeling yourself into ether is pretty magical. And truly, ether really is not that there's magic, but, I mean, I think love is magic. I think having hope is magic. I think having connectedness with our friends, I think that's a representation of magic. Whether you believe in a divine or you just believe in nature or you're just, you know, an existentialist and say this is what it is, you can't deny that there's a social interaction, interconnectedness, and that's what ether represents. And the reason I'm talking about the elements, and I wanted to give you an overview of the elements and the doshas, is to bring it back to this notion of left brain versus right brain when you're thinking about a holistic approach to health. In the beginning, when you start practicing, everything is focused on what you learn in the textbooks or algorithms that you were given. But as you go through medicine, and this is something that I've experienced absolutely with my patients, you start to realize that there's many more ways to treat people. And there's a lot of what we call gray areas within medicine where there isn't a right answer. And sometimes it's having a conversation that matters to a patient. Sometimes it's having them get inspired to eat right, and then that has a domino effect where they start looking at other ways to improve their life or other ways to improve their relationships, and then they start getting holistically well. And you start realizing that, again, just like music, just like if you learn anything for the first time, you got to get that left brain down pat because you need it. That is where the logic comes in, and that is where the technical skill comes in. But if you really want to go to the next level, you need to engage the right brain. But this can be for all of us, even folks that aren't in medicine. And if you're not a physician or a healthcare practitioner, that's fine. The idea is a lot of how you learn to navigate the world is put in a left brain format. And so, and that can drive things like anxiety and stress and just put you out of balance in these micro imbalances that we talk about. And the reason I talk about the different elements in Ayurveda and the doshas is that as you start to see that they're micro imbalances, you can start infusing in solutions that don't always have to be left-brained. You can also have right-brain solutions. So yes, you can talk about nutritional ways that you can help bring yourself into balance. Or it can be exercises or the way you exercise. For example, if you have a tendency towards inflammation, don't go into a super warm or hot room and do yoga because that's just adding more heat to the situation. If your fire element is already a little out of balance, you don't want to add more of a fire element representation. That's just going to make things worse. That's one small example. But on the flip side, then you can start talking about things like mind-body exercises, breathing exercises. And there's not just a one-size-fits-all. It's not just taking a breath in and taking a breath out. That is what I call, by the way, taking your breath for granted. You want to actually pay attention to how you're breathing. What are you doing when you're breathing? How are you thinking when you're breathing? All of these things are right brain. And so I feel in the end, while the left brain's important, when you want to really look at holistic health, you have to engage both brains. And what I'm hoping is, as we bring people on into this podcast and we'll be learning together, we'll learn to engage our entire mind, both sides of it. Not only that, you'll engage the skin, the gut, the mind, the body, and the soul, and all of them will come together so that you'll live more holistically. And I truly, truly do believe that holistic health is better health. And thank you for joining me on this journey. This is the Holistic Health Podcast, brought to you by Jiva Factory. Don't forget to like, rate, and subscribe to our channel, and be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and visit us at jivafactory.com. Check out our membership options to take your health to the next level.